Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. This is Connecting Faith. I remember hearing Becky Pippert some time ago talk about, as she wrote that best-selling book, Out of the Salt Shaker, and she was talking about evangelism. She said, you know, most Christians give answers and preach. Jesus asked questions and told stories. And maybe that's why he was so effective. We're going to talk today about the unexpected power of a question-led life. You're going to learn to be curious. We'll do that in the moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. Great to have you along. Ted Ross at the controls. Ted, you were doing a little Lenten Easter service last night, right?
Right, yeah. I played the role of Nicodemus last night for a Lenten drama. Okay. I've done that for a while, so it was good.
So you you came to Jesus at night, huh?
Yeah.
And asked your questions.
A lot of shame taking place. It was a courtroom setting kind of a thing.
Okay.
So
okay.
Had to be very shameful and embarrassed.
Okay. Okay. And you played your part well?
Yeah,
okay.
I think so. You know, I had to get into the character. So
yeah.
I'm not ashamed, obviously, on Christian radio talking about the Lord. But it was interesting, though. There was a couple people that thought they were confusing Nicodemus with Zacchaeus. So they'd come up to me afterwards and say, oh, and you had to climb up that tree. And I'm like, no,
okay.
No,
right.
No.
Yeah.
You get confused, you know.
Which will maybe tie in with our conversation today, because we're going to talk to a pastor who I'm sure has always faces the challenge of how do I teach God's word to the congregation in a way that they kind of know and retain, right?
Yes,
because
retain.
We don't always remember what we hear. And one of the best ways is to actually ask questions, and we're going to talk about that today. According to the publicity on the book, Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life, says, did you know that of the 183 questions Jesus was asked, he answered only four of them directly?
Hmm.
The other 179 he answered with questions, or sometimes a story. So we're going to talk about that today with Tom Hughes. Tom is the co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly. It's in the L.A. area. And he grew up in the Pittsburgh area, and so is still a rabid Pittsburgh Steelers fan. So that's the only time we're going to mention the Steelers, I think, now.
We'll still welcome him in, yeah.
Sure. We like Mike Tomlin, so that's okay.
Right.
He was headed to law school, and God intervened, sending him into full-time ministry. And after spending some time in England, working on the East Coast, and he came to Pasadena to go to Fuller, and ended up, thanks to a neighbor, getting invited to a church, which was Christian Assembly, and that's where he has been and now been on staff since, 2003 or so, and is leading that, and has joined us today to talk about this wonderful book called Curious, The Unexpected Power, The Question of Life. Tom, good to have you with us here on Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much, Neil, for having me on the show.
So let's start with the issue of Jesus getting asked so many questions but not answering so many. So why did Jesus answer so few questions, do you think?
Well, as you mentioned already, in the four Gospels, he's asked by people a total of 183 questions. He only answers four of those directly. The other 179 questions, he either answers a question with a question. Sometimes he answers the question with a story, or sometimes with a cryptic action. You know, so often as we think about discipleship in America, we think about it as we've got to give answers, we've got to make certain everything's clear for everybody. And yet Jesus so often used questions. I think the reason he used questions is the first part of discipleship is really not only having an understanding of who Jesus is, but also understanding yourself. So many of us live life on autopilot. In fact, you know, in the scriptures, the word that is used to talk about a conversion to Christ is coming awake, the idea of being awakened. In fact, the word saints in the Greek means awakened to awe. And I think questions are what help, in a sense, till up the soil of our heart to allow us to deeply integrate what Jesus is saying to us. So often we see people who might just accept an answer from someone else without deeply integrating it through questions and really wrestling with it. they might be able to say the right answer, but when the rubber meets the road, they find it hard to live out that answer because it hasn't deeply become their own through wrestling with the questions.
In your faith journey and life experience, have you been wrestling with questions, or did you come to faith early and have just kind of, you know, believed it and moved on from there?
You know, I grew up in a Christian home. My mom was a believer. My dad had a faith background, but he actually came to Christ when I was 18. And so I had a foundation, certainly of faith. I had made a commitment to Christ in middle school and high school. But when I went to college, the question that I really had is, am I only a Christian because I grew up in the United States and my parents were Christians? In a sense, is this just a cultural construct, or is this true objectively? Is Jesus not just my Lord, but is he the Lord? And so in college is where I really delved into a lot of questions. As you mentioned, I thought I was going to be headed to law school, and so one of my undergrad majors ended up being world religions, where I studied Islam under an Islamic imam. I studied Buddhism under a Tibetan Buddhist monk as part of my formal education. And that really was where my faith really crystallized, where it wasn't just Jesus is my Savior, but he really is the Lord of the universe, all creation and all people. And that becomes an objective reality, just not something that's true for me, but something that's worth sharing with everyone. So I would say it's really in college where those questions were asked and then more deeply integrated in a way that solidified my faith more substantially.
You know, we know of the stories of situations, maybe it's been our experience too, that, you know, asking questions based on doubt doesn't always seem like it's so well accepted in Christianity. Jesus never really berated those who asked, right? Say more about that.
Yeah, it was interesting. One of my experiences when I was in high school is I was going on a ski trip, and there were two different youth pastors there, and the ski trip was about an hour-long bus ride, so a number of the high school kids, me being one of them, were asking questions of these two youth pastors, and one of them got frustrated with the questions, and he just kept saying, you need to stop asking questions and just believe, and he eventually moved on from the conversation. But the other youth pastor, a guy named Jerry, stayed with us and answered the questions that he could, sometimes asked us questions like Jesus would do, answered our question with the question, and still other times just said, you know, I don't really know. I've often had that question too. And that was really formative for me, Neil, because it showed me that I could be honest with the questions that I had and that God would receive those questions and that God would welcome honest questioning. I think that's the biggest differentiation I see, even as I pastor here in Los Angeles, is if someone's coming with an honest question, I welcome that because I see that as a sign of God at work in their heart. Of course, you do have some people who come asking a question only because they want to argue or they want to debate, and that's a little bit different of a situation than someone who really is asking a question that God's at work in that question in their heart and in their life.
It does, you know, transfer beyond, I guess, pastoral leadership, too, to maybe leadership in general, right? I know you addressed that in the book, Curious, that having a question-led influence is actually a better way, isn't it?
Yeah, I find that to be true. I lead this church called Christian Assembly out here in Los Angeles, and one of the gifts that I get to have is to sit with people and ask them questions. And what I love about that is when I sit and ask them questions, it really does allow God to be the one who's at work, inviting and calling them to step out into some form of leadership. And usually it's in a way that is much more creative than I would have ever thought of. And because it's not my idea that I put on a whiteboard and try to recruit them to, they usually stick with it longer and see greater fruitfulness. So I'll give you one story. It's one of my favorite ones that is currently ongoing. A number of years ago, there was a 20-something-year-old, I think she's about 25 at the time, named Blythe, and Blythe was part of our congregation out here and came to me and said, look, I've been wrestling with, and she's given me permission to share this. She said, I've been wrestling with some pain in my past. She was sexually molested as a little girl, and of course that raises all sorts of questions and pain and trauma, and she was working through that and is a believer, but certainly had some questions connected to that. Well, from that, she then moved into a different set of questions of, you know, here I am. I want to do something with my pain, and I want to make a difference in the area of human trafficking. So human trafficking usually is connected to sexual exploitation of women and children. And so she said, I don't want to have to preach a sermon. I don't want to have to become a public speaker. But what could God do with my life? Well, what was interesting is I didn't have an answer for it. I didn't know exactly how does a 25-year-old in L.A. begin to combat human trafficking. So we prayed and asked God that he would invite her to live into that answer, whatever the answer was to that. And she actually worked at the time in the fashion industry, was an assistant dress designer. And so she started a little social media contest amongst her friends. So she got some of her female friends, and the month of December was coming up. And so she named this little contest Dressember, as a play on the word December. And the idea was, she said to her friends, why don't you wear a dress, and I'm going to wear a dress every single day in the month of December, kind of as a style challenge. And so they did that for a year, and it was just kind of this fun thing. The next year they did it, and she said, this year what I want to do is I want to get our friends and family members to sponsor us. So for every day in the month of December that you wear a dress, you put up a picture on Instagram or, you know, Facebook, they might contribute a little bit of money, like $1 a day or $3 a day. And so they did that in the month of December. And that first year, they raised $10,000. And all of that money went to combat human trafficking. She decided to do it year number two, which is about 3 years ago. And instead of raising $10,000, they ended up raising $165,000. And then word began to spread, and more women began to participate. In fact, it grew to other countries and caught on amongst college campuses. So the third year they did it, instead of $165,000, they raised $465,000 in the month of December and gave all the money to combat human trafficking. This last December, just a couple months ago, was the fourth year that they did it. And this year they raised $1 million in the month of December, with participants from 32 different countries, all six inhabited continents, of women taking pictures of themselves, wearing dresses, putting it on social media, getting their friends to sponsor them, and all of the money going to combat human trafficking in Jesus' name. Now, what I love about that is, had you asked me that day, Tom, what would your vision be of how God would want to use Blythe's life? I'm not creative enough to come up with that answer. And it's just been amazing to watch that story unfold. And the more you see stories like that unfold, the more it gives you the idea, you know, maybe I just need to ask questions and allow God to be the one at work here.
Mm. God, what could you do with my life? You know, what would happen if we all asked that question honestly and sincerely and allowed God to answer and to move, as Tom has just shared that powerful story here on Connecting Faith. We're talking Curious. That's the title of the book, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. I hope that you maybe have been sparked to maybe ask a question. And maybe you have some questions about identity. Who am I? That's one of the primary questions. We'll have Tom weigh in on that in a moment as well. And we'll talk about even how to make good decisions. And maybe there's a question that every church should ask. We'll hear that and more in the moments ahead. We've got some copies of the book Curious to give away. You'll find it a great encouragement, a challenge, and a good resource. And you can be a part of the drawing for that. We'll do the drawing at the top of the hour whenever we have resources to give away. We always take names and do the drawing then at the end of the program. So call us at 877-933-2484 to be in the drawing for the book Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life, written by Tom Hughes. Tom is the co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly in Los Angeles, joining us today on Connecting Faith, 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question for us, love to have you join the program as well. Stay tuned.
Who am I that the Lord of all the earth would care to know my name, would care to feel my hurt?
Talking identity in the moments ahead on Connecting Faith with Tom Hughes. Tom's co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly, has a bachelor's in world religion, sociology, and environmental studies from Ohio Wesleyan University, and a master's from Fuller Theological Seminary. He's been on the staff at Christian Assembly here for a dozen or more years, the co-lead pastor there, and has written a wonderful new book called Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. And in the book, Curious, you, Tom, you address the issue of, you know, this primary question of life, who am I? Let's talk about finding our identity.
Yeah, that's certainly a cultural touch point in a lot of the discussions. I'm certain all over the country, but certainly here in Los Angeles as well. And I think it's a question that is ingrained in all of us as people to ask, you know, who am I really? What is my identity? And then from that, how do I answer that question? And more importantly, how do I live out that question? I think that's part of the power of a question-led life. It's not just having answers that you say, but having answers that you live into with God's help. And so often we see this in the scriptures. I think many of us will see this in our own life or maybe in lives of others around us. The two most common ways that people answer the identity question is first, we answer it with what other people say about us. This is true for all of us. It can be true for a mom or dad who base their identity on whether their kids said something good about them that day or not good. It could be based, you know, on what our boss thinks about us, what our spouse, what a friend, what a neighbor. And so often we can have our identity rise or fall, what we think about ourselves, based upon the opinions of others. Now, that's not wholly a bad thing, but that's not the primary way that the scriptures would have us find and live out our identity. The second way that we often do it in America is we turn to answering that question by what we've done. Now, again, that's not horrible. Accomplishments are a good thing, but accomplishments are not the primary way that the scriptures would have us answer who we are. In fact, according to the scriptures, I would argue that the truest thing about us is what God says. And what God says about us is that we're loved. And I think that's the fundamental question of who am I that leads to the very greatest sense of joy and peace, but also faithfulness in knowing and following Christ is beginning the story of my life with, I am someone that God created in his image, and he loves me. And once we begin to live from the place that I'm loved by God who created me in his image, because he loves me that much, he's the one who thought me up, and he wanted me to be, so he brought that about, that frees us in a lot of ways to then live in a different way. So now instead of relating to people based off of what we want from them, maybe we want their approval or we want their applause, instead now we can relate to them based on what we want for them. We can begin to serve them from the position of love, and that's certainly something we see Christ calling us to. But answering that identity question through the fact that we're loved by God is the beginning point of living into the answer of what that looks like in our everyday life.
You know, so many of us come with baggage, though, don't we? We have, and that has influenced our identity. So how do we account for that baggage when we're working through these fundamental questions?
Yeah, that's one of the chapters as well. We call it in the book, we call it the recovery question. Can God do something better with my baggage? And certainly that is a tender process. It's not one that's prone to be served well by cliches. But I do think, and I've seen through countless stories, how God uses our baggage and our pain first to heal us, but then to also use it, sometimes our misery becomes our greatest ministry. For example, in the book, I tell the story of a guy named Mauricio. It's one of the clearest stories that I know of somebody's pain being used for something better. Mauricio was born in Nicaragua in a mountainous village. And after his mom gave birth to him, he was not wanted by his mom. The dad wasn't in the picture, alcoholic father who had fathered 27 children by a variety of different women in that mountainous village. So the mom was incredibly poor, and she took the baby after he was born and took him to an outhouse and threw him down into the outhouse, into the muck, into the slop, into the excrement. And the idea was that he would drown in it. Well, what happened was when he landed in the excrement, there was a plank there. So he landed on a plank and was floating, crying, obviously, as a baby. She went and got some rocks and tried to actually throw down on him to knock him off the plank and put him into the excrement so that he would drown. But that wasn't effective because the angle of it, of where the plank was. So she left. a little bit later, some boys were playing nearby, and they heard a baby crying. And so they went and they looked down the outhouse and they saw the baby down there. So they called a man that was nearby, and he was working with some cattle. He got a rope and tied it to a post and lowered himself literally down into the excrement and rescued baby Mauricio. Baby Mauricio was eventually adopted by his paternal aunt. So it was his alcoholic father's sister that adopted him. They immigrated to the United States. The whole time he's thinking that his aunt is actually his mom. When he's 13 years old, she tells him the story, lets him know, I'm not actually your biological mom, I'm your aunt. Well, from 13 to about 21, he had to work through all that pain with the help of a good Christian counselor. He worked through the pain of that. God, where were you? What were you up to? A couple years later, he's reading God's word, and he feels like God says, you need to go back to Nicaragua, find your mom, and forgive her. So he actually goes back to that mountainous village. Not much had changed there. There was still the outhouse there. And finds his mom and forgives her. Well, she ends up denying the whole story, even though she has no way of explaining how she was fully pregnant and then didn't have a baby around the house after, or around the hut or village after giving birth. And everybody in the village said, no, that's actually what happened. So he's down in Nicaragua, and he leans against a tree next to the outhouse, and he says, God, this is such a failure. I came down here. I thought, you know, I was going to lead her to you. I thought I was going to give her a Bible, and she was going to come to know Christ, and none of that happened. Why did you bring me down here? And he opened up God's word, and it fell to the passage of Scripture that says, even if my father and mother reject me, the Lord will not. And he felt like God said, I want to use your pain for something better. And so from that time, down there in Nicaragua, he's now decided that God is inviting him, calling him, to buy the land in Nicaragua around that outhouse and turn it into a prenatal care facility with job training for women so that no other women in that area of Nicaragua will ever have to throw their baby down into an outhouse again because they don't want the child because of the extreme poverty. And so Mauricio is only 29 years old. He started an organization called Tree of Life, and he has since moved to Nicaragua. It's one of the five remaining communist countries. He has dual citizenship. Normally, the Nicaraguan government would never allow a Christian ministry to begin, but because his is trying to help orphans and help combat poverty through job training, they're allowing it to happen. And so he's moved down there, is buying the land, raising the money to buy the land, and begin to do a job training and prenatal care facility for women in that area. I think so often our suffering comes from not knowing how God's going to use our pain. But when we see how he uses our pain, that gives us greater joy and peace.
That's such a powerful story. I'm so glad you shared it, Tom. And we have more stories from the wonderful book called Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. We invite you to join in. We have some copies to give away. You can sign up for that at 877-93-FAITH and join us with a question as well. We'll continue in just a minute. Two past the hour, and enjoying a conversation today with Tom Hughes, is co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly in Los Angeles. Their worship is led by Tommy Walker, who wrote that great tune. So we thought we'd play a little Tommy Walker bumper just for Tom, make you feel more comfortable. Appreciate you joining us today and sharing out of your heart this wonderful book called Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. And Tom, as a pastor, I know you always want your congregation, I'm sure, and all of us really realize that the community needs to be so important. You address that as well. How does a question-led life help us address community?
Well, I think one of the very first questions that we have to ask about community is why so few of us have that in a stable, ongoing way. You know, there's many of us, for example, who maybe we've moved around because of job or other circumstances, and yet we can tend to lead these kind of isolated lives. And how do we then ask the right questions that will get us into community, and not just get us into community, but keep us in community whenever community becomes challenging? Because, of course, any community that you're part of, whether it's a family, whether it's a team, or certainly maybe a small group at church or part of a congregation, is going to have challenging times and challenging relationships in it. So how do we stick it out in the midst of those? Well, one of the things, one of the questions we often ask the people in our congregation is, do you really think your life will be better if it's let alone, if it's by yourself? Now, maybe when things are going well, that'll be great. But whenever things get challenging, we need a community around us that are going to encourage us, lift us up, bear some of our burdens. And maybe even more importantly, when things are going well in our life, we need to take our place to encourage and build up others. So many people I meet with, whenever they come to me, they might be in a crisis. Hey, this is going on in my life, that's going on in my life. And the people who are most resilient in their faith, but also most resilient in life, are the ones that have a community around them. They already have that community established so that whenever the storm hits, they're not facing that storm alone. People who wait until the storm hits and then try to develop a community often find that it's a lot harder to do that. And so we ask a lot of questions about what does it look like to be a healthy community and how do we live into those answers. And for us, the answers that we try to live into are the ones that take an honest look at some of our natural ways of doing community, like we'll be part of this community as long as it meets our needs, or we'll jump into that program, but we're not necessarily reaching out outside of the program to help others around us. Those are the things that lead to weak community. And instead, what we'd say, look, we want a community that we recognize that community can be difficult and not easy, that the best communities are relational, not just programmatic, that the best communities are ones where we all give something and not just take something. They're leader-driven and not just need-centered. They're open to others and not just closed. It's not just us four and no more. And the very best communities have an outward component where we serve and love those outside of our community who are not yet part of it yet. So those are some of the guideposts that we have that, as we've been asking those questions, that have guided us to not just have those guideposts to stay, but to live into those and really guide what a healthy community looks like for us. And so in our congregation, I think now we have somewhere around 225 different small groups that meet on a weekly basis. And inviting people to be part of that and not just be in those groups, but really do life together and do the Christ-centered life together.
You know, community, as you said, it's not always easy, particularly as we get into community with people of other ethnicities, and which is God's design ultimately, right? And you address that, the multi-ethnic church. And, you know, we like who we like, but, you know, kind of rubbing shoulders sometimes with the, those that are different, that takes an extra challenge.
Yeah, the church that I serve here, we're in a neighborhood of Los Angeles called Eagle Rock. And Eagle Rock, according to the LA Times, is the most diverse neighborhood in all of Los Angeles. So it's the most diverse neighborhood in a very diverse city. There's no majority ethnicity in our neighborhood. And what's been great is in the church, there's no majority ethnicity. So we have literally every different background you could imagine represented in our congregation. And of course, that raises a lot of, at times, challenges and conflicts. What I love about it is if you are ever with us on a weekend, you look around, you would look and say, there is no reason all these people would be together of their own free choice other than the fact that they believe in Jesus Christ. Now, that does lead to a lot of challenging conversations, including things like how do we respond to the conversation around Black Lives Matter? What does that look like? How do we incarnate reconciliation as a church in a way that serves one another, that doesn't seek to just make arguments, but instead really live out what does it look like that we're brothers and sisters in Christ? One of my favorite stories is from years ago on this. The church Christian Assembly started in 1907. So it's, I guess, 109 years old now. And most things that are 109 years old are dying or about to die, and that includes a lot of local congregations that are 109 years old. But for whatever reasons, Christian assemblies continue to flourish even as 109 years old. Well, in the late 60s or early 70s, the church was called the Italian Christian Assembly, and all of the preaching and teaching was done in Italian, and so all of the people in the church were Italians. But the neighborhood started to change, become more English-speaking, and so they invited an intern to start teaching and speaking some in English. And they had a little white bus that they would drive around the neighborhood and pick up kids and bring them to church. And on the side of the bus, it said Italian Christian Assembly. Well, one day, the pastor, who the intern had become the pastor, and the previous guy had retired, and he received a phone call, and the people on the other end of the phone said, "Is it okay if we attend your church?" And the pastor said, "What? I don't understand. What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, we're not Italians, but we moved into the neighborhood. Would it be okay for us to come to your church?" And he said, "Well, yeah, of course, of course." And he said, "Why would you ever think that?" He said, "Well, you're called the Italian Christian Assembly, so we thought only Italians were welcome." And so he, you know, explained that that was just the name, but they didn't mean for that to be the case. And so he got off the phone and he said, "What are we going to do?" He said this to Art Botta, a proud Italian man who drove the bus. And Art said, "I'll fix that today." He went to the local hardware store, got a can of white paint, and he painted over the word Italian. And what I love about that is Art was 100% Italian, loved Italian, spoke Italian, was renowned for being a great Italian food maker. And so he was proud about his ethnicity and his heritage, and yet he didn't let that become an obstacle or a stumbling block for the gospel. And so he painted over the word Italian on the bus, and that's how Christian Assembly went from the Italian Christian Assembly to just being called Christian Assembly. If you came today to Christian Assembly, I would say maybe 3 to 4% of our congregation have an Italian background. The other 96% who come and feel at home because 50 years ago, a proud Italian was willing to say, "My identity in Christ is more important to me than my identity as an Italian," and open the door for all those other people to find a home at Christian Assembly.
Which I guess maybe should be a challenge to all of us, right? Maybe as a pastor or church leader, is there a question that every church should ask? And maybe it's asking that question, is it okay to attend your church?
Yeah, and I think being intentional and honest about how are we in an increasingly multi-ethnic culture exemplifying God's plan to bring people together of every tribe, tongue, and nation. Now, that how you live out that question is going to look very different depending on the neighborhood that you're in. So, for example, we're in a very diverse neighborhood. So for us, as we reach out to our neighborhood, our church becomes very diverse. I have another friend who leads a church in the state of Washington. His county that his church is in is 94% white. And so for them to be diverse in their congregation is a little bit of a challenge because their entire 94% of their neighborhood is white. And yet their church is 88% white. And so what he says is we actually are more diverse than our county. And so they've been intentional in that. They've been intentional. They feel like God's been inviting them to build intentional partnerships with churches, black churches that they're partnered with, or Latino churches, both in the state of Washington, but also in other parts of the country and other parts of the world as well. So there are a lot of different ways that we want to live out that multi-ethnic vision that God has for his kingdom. And I think if we're in an area that's predominantly homogenous, where everybody kind of looks the same and has the same ethnicity, I don't think we can use that as an excuse to say, well, there's nothing I can do. Instead, I think we have to figure out ways to create partnership where we are modeling God's vision for his kingdom.
Talking today with Tom Hughes, who co-pastors Christian Assembly in L.A. He's written a wonderful book called Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. In the book, you address not only questions that matter for life and faith, but the life of faith, but then asking our way to the world God wants, asking those right questions. And one of those has to do with this. You know, if our church moved out of the neighborhood, would anyone care? And at the beginning of that chapter, you quote Dr. Martin Luther King. He said, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? I think that's one of those areas where we probably really need to continue to wrestle with, don't we, as God's people?
Yeah, and we, at that time, were, as a leadership team, the church was growing. But we kept asking that question. Okay, the church is growing, and things were going well for the church. But the question that we kept asking is, for the people who don't attend Christian Assembly, if we all picked up and moved to Oregon, if we all picked up and moved to Minnesota, would anybody who does not attend the church care? Would they be sad if we left? And we didn't really have an answer to that, to be honest. Now, we did our fair share of service days and painting over graffiti and cleaning things up and all sorts, you know, things like that. But we were really asking God to help us find a way to consistently and intentionally love our neighbors, not just through those one-off events and not just through a random conversation, but through a sustainable action. And we found, as we prayed and asked that question, that God was stirring that in our congregation as well. And some people began to arise who God used them to help us live into the answer. And one of the stories of that is I had a 20-something-year-old female. We have a number of 20-somethings in our church. And she came and said, look, I used to be a public school teacher, but I didn't want to do that anymore. I want to make a difference in this neighborhood. And so we actually spent a year meeting, talking, and praying, what would it look like if God would use us, and particularly use Sarah, is her name. And we began to explore Sarah's story. What are you passionate about? What has God put in you? And Sarah, growing up, was an at-risk kid. She grew up in Michigan and moved to L.A. When she became an adult. She was an at-risk kid, had a heart for at-risk kids, had a heart for the public schools. Los Angeles Unified School District is the second largest school district in the country, and there's a number of at-risk kids in the school district. And so she eventually, as we kept praying and she kept exploring and taking steps, heard about an organization called Kids Hope. And Kids Hope seeks to mobilize a local church to mentor the at-risk kids at their local elementary school. So Sarah said, well, what if we tried to do that? And we literally sat and talked. We're like, we don't even know that this is going to be possible in Los Angeles. Are they really going to let a Christian church come on campus and mentor at-risk kids, or is this going to become a big political battle? So Sarah went to the headquarters of the Los Angeles Unified School District, went to the 38th floor of their high-rise, and basically just said, this is what I want to do, fully expecting that she might get a no. But they ended up unanimously supporting the idea and allowing it to become a trial concept. So she started. She mobilized the first year as a volunteer, 10 people, to mentor 10 at-risk kids at our local elementary school. The at-risk kids were identified by the teachers and by the school administrators. And so they would just go to the school, these volunteers, every week for an hour, and mentor these kids in reading or writing or math. Sometimes they would just shoot hoops with them and talk with them about life because they might have behavior problems or different things like that. And so they did that the first year. It went well. Did it the second year. It went well. And so then it became a permanent program. And from there, it went from 10 kids to 20 kids to then 40 kids to then 60 kids to then 85 kids. So we now have 85 people from our church who go every week to our local elementary school and mentor the at-risk kids there. And what I love about it, Neil, is the principal at the school is not a Christian. And she was asked at a local university, she was sitting on an educational panel. She said, one of the students said, what's the most exciting thing happening in public education today? And this was her answer. She said, the most exciting thing that's happening in public education today is Christian Assembly Church. And she said, now listen, I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any God. But if I ever believe in a God, I'm going to believe in their God, because their God makes life better for the most at-risk kids in my school. And I just thought, what a great way, what a great testimony of all of those people in our church who are laying down their life 1 hour at a time to care for the most at-risk kids in our neighborhood. And now we would say confidently, not only through that, but other different ministries that have developed from asking that question, we would say if we picked up and moved to Minnesota or Oregon or somewhere else, that there would be literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in our neighborhood who would be sad. And so that gives us joy to know that we're not just making a difference within the community of faith, but also for those who have not yet come to know Christ.
I bet you've heard our conversation today. You can think about maybe there's some needs that you see in your immediate neighborhood, and there may be a way that you can do something about one of them, like Sarah's story, Tom Hughes telling the stories today of God at work through asking questions. Curious is the book we're referencing, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. Tom is co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly Church in Los Angeles and author of this wonderful book. We've got some copies to give away. If you'd like to sign up for that, we'll do the drawing here at the top of the hour, 877-933-2484. And maybe that as you read through the book, you'll be inspired to find some ways to be the hands and feet of Jesus in your community. We're going to talk more about how we can leave a legacy and not live life regretfully. And we'll get to that here in just a minute. We've got a few minutes left. If you have a question for us as well, you can join us at 877-933-2484.
Build your kingdom.
Taking place. Tom Hughes has recounted just a number of wonderful examples this hour and through his book, Curious, about God at work when we begin to let questions to lead us. Curious is the name of the book, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. Tom Hughes is a co-pastor, co-lead pastor at Christian Assembly Church in Los Angeles. He was telling a little bit earlier Sarah's story about KidsHopeUSA.org. You want to find out more about that, KidsHopeUSA.org. And then Mauricio's story, thank you, you can confirm it, Tom. It's TreeOfLife84.com. Is that right? Does that sound
right?
That's
correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Tree of Life 84.
And then the earlier story I told, about Blythe, people can find by just Googling Dressember, okay. Dressember, and they can see more information there. They're partnered up with an organization called International Justice Mission.
Good. Wonderful stories and opportunities to see our life be part of God's kingdom advance. I'm thinking that you spent a little time in the book talking about decision-making principles, maybe some good questions to ask after bad decisions, because we've all, had, too many of those. Just say a word about that.
Yeah, I think so often what happens if your listeners are anything like me, after I make a bad decision and I realize it was a bad decision, I see the consequences of the bad decision, I'm inclined to basically just write it off like, well, that was a bad decision, and I hope I don't do that again. I think at the end of the day, that, of course, is okay, but it doesn't really help us process that. Instead, I think, what I say in the book is we need to never waste a bad decision. When you make a bad decision, you want to come to a place of asking good questions about that bad decision. So some of the questions that I ask myself or we ask as a leadership team when we come to a time where we made a poor decision is we ask questions like, how did we get to the point where we thought that would be a good decision? Or what did I not see that I see now? Or what did I misunderstand? Or what was I missing? Sometimes we ask the question of what question should I have been asking that I didn't ask that would have allowed me to travel down a different path. One of the other questions I often ask so often in my own life, but in others' lives as I sit with them as a pastor, is what role did my emotions play in this bad decision? Sometimes we can make a bad decision because of our anger or our fear or our envy, and that can set us up for making a bad decision. So then the question becomes, the next time around, when I know that I'm feeling afraid or feeling angry or feeling envious, how do I take a breath and step back and not rush into a decision or make an impulsive decision that later will, bring about negative consequences in my life. The other things that I ask is, who did I make the decision with? Now, sometimes you make decisions alone, but the bigger the decision is, I think the more we need to invite, as the scriptures say, the wisdom of many counselors. And so as we have that big decision coming up in our life, maybe it's a crossroad decision, it's important to think through and say, who did I have around the table, and did I have the right people around the table? So if it's a bad decision, the question might be, did I seek out counsel of others? And if the answer is, yeah, I did seek out counsel, did I seek out the right kind of counsel? Did I have the right kinds of people involved in that decision-making process? And so when I ask those questions, and as we do that maybe as a team, or even if it's just my wife and I, you know, asking about a decision we made in our family or whatever it might be, by asking those questions, that helps set us up for the next time around. The next time we come to a similar type of question or a similar type of decision, we can look back and say, okay, this time we're going to do it differently. We're not going to let that emotion, because, you know, play such a big role. Or we're going to make certain we get the advice of this additional person who might have the insight we need to make a wise decision moving forward. So anytime we make a bad decision, I think there's a chance for us to process that decision with questions, and then those questions help us to not waste it so that next time we can make a better decision with God's help.
Well, speaking of wasting, our time is gone. We don't want to waste the last 2 minutes, but I do want to talk about, you know, how we don't waste our life, because you do focus on about, a legacy. And so say just maybe some final thoughts about how we can, you know, not live with regrets, but live a legacy.
Yeah, that word legacy, it comes from the word legate, which in the Roman days was the word for ambassador. And I think that gives us a clue. In the scriptures, we're called to be, as we follow Christ, ambassadors for Christ. One of the surveys that I ran across was of 95-year-old people or older, and they were asked the question, what do you wish you had done differently in your life? And these were their top three answers. They said, I wish I had reflected more, I wish I had taken more risks, and I wish I had lived for something that would outlive me. And as I think about those three answers, that's the very thing I'm trying to get at with this idea of being curious, that we pause to reflect more. And as we ask God our prayerful questions, that we'll take risks as steps of faith that he asks us to take. And then as we do that, that then we will live for something that will outlive us, which is God's kingdom. And in fact, for your listeners, they can get a copy of the book on Amazon.com. And the book, each chapter is a different question. But at the end of each chapter are discussion questions that they can use with a small group, or you could also use that in your own private journaling time. So I think no regret legacy making comes down to saying, okay, as I follow you, Christ, I want to be your ambassador. How can I live a life where I reflect on what you're asking of me, have the courage to take those risks, and as I do that, trust that my life will be something that counts for something more than just simply me.
Reflect and then have courage to move forward and trust as you go along. A good final word from Tom Hughes today. Tom's co-lead pastor of Christian Assembly in Los Angeles, joining us today, talking about his new book, Curious, The Unexpected Power of a Question-Led Life. And you can find it at a bookstore near you. It's published by NAB Press. Tom, really encouraging today. So glad to have had the opportunity just to hear some of the stories and be challenged again. And I just wish you continued blessing and direction as you ask questions and then follow up with the answers as God leads.
Thank you, Neil, and thank you, dear listeners, for giving me the time today.
Tom Hughes joining us today on Connecting Faith. You want to pass this interview along to someone else to encourage them, you can do that. We post all our conversations online on the show page at myfaithradio.com. So if you go there after the show, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page, you can find the podcast archives of this interview and others, and pass it on to a friend, encourage them. And thank you for joining us. We always appreciate your company and your reflection here on Connecting Faith.